You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
They're saying I should think stuff. Something is wrong with me.
Practice.
It's another edition of Positive Cynicism here on the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network, and this month, the month of July 2019, we have something special planned across all four or five episodes for this month. I believe there's 5 weeks in July, so there'll be a bonus episode, which you don't have to be a subscriber to our Patreon to enjoy. It's free for you. But this month we are going to travel back in time, and every episode will focus on 1999. Yes, we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of 1999. And given some of the pre-work that we've done, some of the research, I think this is going to be a very interesting month to look back at the past, to see how it has helped shape the future that we live in now. Or I guess that would be the present that we live in now, and see where the future may go based on everything that keeps repeating from the past. Once again, I've started rambling in the open, so I'm just going to give the plugs for all the other shows here on the Jittery Monkey Network. My 1-2-3 cents with Kevin's. Let's try that again. My 1-2-3 cents with Kevin Hunsberger. Nerds United with Greg Mahochko and the co-host of the year, Mike Luther, and Greg's other show, Five Heart. You can hear them all at jitterymonkey.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, if you go over to jitterymonkey.com, there is a store where you can buy Jittery Monkey merchandise. I highly recommend picking up one of the Positive Cynicism t-shirts because I have bills to pay. And the only way we make money here on the Jittery Monkey Network is through merchandise sales. So please, go buy a shirt. Help support struggling podcast artist. Anyway, we're going to take a commercial break and be right back looking at the year of 1999.
Hi, this is Greg Mahochko, the host of Nerds United on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. And over the years that I've been running the Nerds United show, I've been fortunate enough to speak with many of my talented friends, both artists and writers, creators of comic books, but I've also spoken with some more recognizable names in comics and entertainment. Legendary artist Greg Land, hey, we Greg's gotta stick together. Writer Colin Bunn, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and comic book creator DMC Daryl McDaniels. The Flash of yesteryear, and in more recent memory, Flash's dad, John Wesley Shipp, and a lot more. And I encourage you to subscribe to the Nerds United podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can check it out anytime you want on jitterymonkey.com. And as founder of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network, I really do appreciate your support. When you share a podcast, you help get our little corner of the podcasting world out to even more people. So anytime you do that, you really don't know how much we appreciate it. So share away. I just wanna go back to 1999. Take a ride to my old neighborhood. I just wanna go back. Sing Hit Me Baby one more time.
Yes, I said we were going to be talking about 1999 all this month, and I bet you expected to hear the song 1999 by Prince. But no, there is a new song called 1999 by Charlie XCX and Troy Sivan. See, we're being hip here on Positive Cynicism. And speaking of hip, on the other side of the country is the Travis Yates. That's right, you can find him on Twitter at the Travis Yates. He is our sports and communications expert here on Positive Cynicism. Travis, welcome to the show. And are you down with Charlie XCX?
Yeah, I was going to say you're being hip. I am not, because I have no idea who you're talking about. But I just feel bad that I can't bring the musical stylings of Prince to the show. So we're going to have a lot of disappointed listeners out there.
Well, maybe we'll close the show with Prince, depending on how the conversation goes. And speaking of Prince, cheap little plug for my recent trip to Minnesota. But I got to go to Paisley Park and take the tour. And if you are ever in Minnesota, I don't care what part of the state, you should always travel down to the outskirts of Minneapolis and go to Paisley Park, because it is an amazing facility and just reminds you how awesome Prince was, and still is, for that matter.
Still is, yeah. What's the latest on his album of unreleased music that was found and supposedly going to be released? Have you heard?
I've not heard anything specific. I'm sure that we will get Prince albums for the next 50 years. There was a new album that did come out, and I actually bought it at the Minneapolis airport. Has a Prince store.
Wow.
Yeah, and they were selling this new CD, which I guess came out a few months ago, and it's all, or not all, but it's a collection of songs that Prince wrote that other artists recorded, but it's Prince singing. So it's got Jungle Time, Nothing Compares to You, Glamorous Life, Manic Monday, and a bunch of other songs.
Wow. Yeah. It's like a tribute album by Prince.
Yes.
You'd think it'd be the other way around, where we're doing the tribute to Prince, but no.
Yeah, you know, I think Prince is probably the only person who could really get away with doing his own tribute album.
Yes, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we should just insert some Prince here now, just for the sake of Prince.
Absolutely.
All right, let's get on to 1999. Travis, do you remember where you were in 1999?
I do remember where I was in 1999, and it was a very pivotal. I'm making up words. It was so amazing.
Is that like pivotal and pitiful?
No, it wasn't pitiful at all. It was a pivotal year for young Mr. Yates, who was entering his second year in the broadcast world, and met my future wife, and so a lot happened in 1999. Yeah, it was a good year.
Yeah, and can you believe that it has been 20 years since 1999?
No, I can't. You know, I used to mark things by how long it had been from the 80s, mm-hmm. and so in the 90s, you know, I was doing, I can't believe it's been 12 years. I can't believe it's been, you know, 17 years since, you know, this happened in 1982, 1983. So yeah, now that we're at the 20-year mark of the last year of 1999, is a tough pill to swallow for this middle-aged podcaster.
Yeah, because realistically speaking, we're just a few short months away from the 40th anniversary of Mount St. Helens.
Jeez, yeah. I don't feel my age, and so I think that's one of the reasons it's so hard to wrap my head around, you know, dates like that, stats like that.
Yeah, I normally don't feel my age, but while I was in Minnesota as well, I took my nephew to a trampoline park, and that reminded me that I am old and should not be jumping on trampolines.
Yeah, every now and again, you do get a little pushback from the body saying, no, you know, you've got 43-year-old knees. Don't do that again.
Yeah. And then you, I don't know, I was trying to come up with a over 40 athlete to reference, and my mind is going blank, so.
Yeah, because hardly any of them exist. That's why.
I was going to say, how old is Tom Brady right now?
Yeah, he's 41, I think.
Okay.
Maybe older. Right. But yeah, he's certainly one of them. I think Ben Roethlisberger, I think, is 39. Let's just quickly do this because we can't. He's 41. Yeah. So there you go.
There you go.
There's our.
But yeah, most athletes by the time they reach 40 are either out of the game or hanging on too long just because they made bad investments and didn't spend their money or save the money wisely.
Most of them, yeah. Unless you're Tom Brady and you're still on top of the world winning championships.
Let's not talk about Tom Brady.
Okay.
He has to retire at some point, right?
He does. Hopefully. But I mean, that could be 6 years from now. I'm waiting for like the big news this offseason that he signed a 5-year extension to end his career, and which would make him 46 when he retires. So a couple more years, I think.
Well, someday I keep hoping out that the Dolphins will have a chance at winning the AFC East, but not until Brady is gone and probably until Belichick retires.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bills and the Jets are out of the league as well.
No, they're not that bad. Yeah. I have a lot of faith in the direction they're heading. I think this will be the best couple seasons of Dolphins football that you've seen, minus the growing pains of this year, since the late 90s.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, we'll see about that. And we'll throw a cheap plug here, since we're talking football. Travis, you also work with a football podcast and website, I believe. If you want to plug that real quick.
Yeah, it's profootballnetwork.com. Find them on Twitter at PFN365. I am the Bengals beat writer. I do some other stuff for the AFC North, and I write for the fantasy section. Just amazing football people with amazing football minds. So if you just like reading about the game or your favorite team, or you're into fantasy and you're looking for some insight there, profootballnetwork.com is really... It's just a fantastic wealth of information for football people.
All right, check that out. But now let's get back to 1999, because I have notes here that I want to go over. And I think the first thing that we have to talk about is probably the most significant event of 1999. And that is Susan Lucci won her first Daytime Emmy Award after 19 nominations.
I mean, the world just stopped and watched, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that is the highest rated Daytime Emmy Award presentation ever.
There was Lucci watch every year.
Yeah. And
it was always, it's got to be this year, and it never was.
It never was. And yeah. I think it's like the Cubs winning the World Series. Like, everyone just waited and waited, and then once they won, no one cared anymore.
Right. The legend of Susan Lucci, would it have been even bigger had she never won?
I think so. And I think the Cubs never should have won the World Series. That's just me. When I started tossing out this idea of doing a retrospect of 1999, the way that I was looking at this year is kind of like the last year of innocence because of some events that happened in the following years. But looking at 1999 as a whole, I was reminded that there was a lot of tragedy in 1999. Even though, like we said, Susan Lucci won Daytime Emmy and SpongeBob SquarePants premiered, probably the biggest story of at least... Well, I'm going to say the biggest story of 1999, since Y2K kind of fizzled out on January 1st, 2000. But, a story that we still deal with today is the Columbine shooting.
Yeah, I look at 99 as not necessarily the loss of innocence, but almost like we reached the finish line of the 90s decade, which was the stripping of our innocence. Mm. It was interesting because when you look at 1999, you have to look at the past decade as a whole, right? It's the culmination, it's the end of it. So we always take stock as a society, right? We always kind of we put it all we put everything in decades. You know, oh, it was the 60s. It was the era of you know, the free love. In the 70s, it was the disco and it was self-discovery. And then the 80s was the decade of excess. And then the Cold War ended in, you know, 89 with tearing down a Berlin Wall. And then 2 years later, the crumbling of the Soviet Union. It left the United States as the like unquestioned superpower of the world. So, you know, life was good. There were no major foreign threats. The economy was good. We were on the cusp of the digital age, the era of the computer, the personal computer in our homes. And it's almost like we got idle hands and we turned inwards and kind of almost began to tear ourselves apart from the inside out. Because like you said, the tragedy, not only in 99, but through the whole 90s, and it was all internal. It started with the Rodney King and the race riots that followed there. You mentioned Columbine at the end. But then in between, you had the Centennial Park bombing during the Atlanta Olympics. You had the Oklahoma City bombing. You had Waco. You know, everything that we've been fighting for, from World War II through Vietnam, the Gulf War, whatever vision we had for the country, it wasn't enough. You know, it wasn't the utopia that we, I guess, expected the 90s would be. It, you know, obviously, if we now have children shooting up schools, domestic terrorism, fabricated wars for the profits of politicians. So I almost view it as just not the loss of innocence all in 1 year, but just the final touches on a decade that stripped us of our innocence or our at least hopes of what we had for our society. Kind of depressing, but...
Yeah, and that you make a good point. I was just thinking while you were talking about the early days of the 90s and how the 80s, you know, I'm a big music fan. And so looking at the music of the 90s, you know, the late 80s, you had the hair bands and glam rock, which were all about, like you said, excess and just partying and having a good time. And then with 1991, we saw the release of Nevermind by Nirvana and the switching to the grunge movement, which was a more kind of cynical attitude in music. And then obviously with Kurt Cobain's suicide in 1994. But yeah, you see that theme carried out throughout the entire 90s. And I mean, you make a great point. I hadn't even thought about all the internal strife as a whole.
You know, grunge music is a great way to kind of encapsulate what was happening, because it's, you know, it was really a resurgence of punk. Grunge is a cousin of punk, which is a rebellion against the society norms. And you know, like you mentioned, Kurt Cobain taking the reign there as the ringleader. But it was a disenfranchised youth. Almost, you know, they're like realizing that the bill of goods that they were sold through, you know, all of the pop culture through the 80s, Saturday morning cartoons, sitcoms, blockbuster movies, it wasn't the real deal. And, you know, they were now reaching adulthood and they were pissed because it wasn't what they had expected, and they were rebelling, and they, you know, grunge is a perfect reflection of that.
Okay. We're going to tie kind of moving into the present here, because as I said in the cold open about how looking at the past to see how it shapes our present, that I see that cynicism is still present today. And do you think there's any way to, let me rephrase that, do you see a potential to erase that cynicism, or is it just something that is going to be a part of life for, I guess, at least the rest of our lives?
Well, I don't want to take a political slant on this episode, but I will say no, I have my doubts that we can erase that cynicism. I think that the upcoming 2020 elections and the aim that some of the politicians have for their platforms, you know, erasing college debt, healthcare for all, you know, these are some of the things now that people are so cynical about. And so, you know, if we go in a direction where our own government actually takes steps that looks like they care for us and want us to succeed, you know, that might help. in moving in that direction. And again, I don't want to get real political about it and get into what's right and what's not. But I think that that's a couple ways where you could reach a mass amount of people and maybe start to change their mind of having that cynical outlook. Because, I mean, I'm sorry, but the systems are failing. Mm-hmm. You know, capitalism is failing. And, you know, we are being taken advantage of as everyday consumers on every single level, from college students to senior citizens, with these programs that aren't doing what they're going to do, in a healthcare system that, you know, is just destroying people as families and physically because they're not getting the treatment they need. So of course everybody should be cynical. Can we find some positive cynicism in that? That's the question moving forward, and I think that the upcoming election will have a lot to do with that. I don't know socially how else we can do that. People are trying. You know, it's Self-Help Central out there right now, and there's a lot of great groups and organizations that are trying to help, but I think it's going to have to come from a huge mass level, like a, you know, government shifting, a major shift in the way we're governed to kind of do that on a mass level.
All right, well, I'll throw in another cheap plug here. On episode 101 of Positive Cynicism, coming up in 2 weeks from when this episode drops, we will have an episode full of politics, and we'll be discussing the recent Democratic debates, as well as comparing the 1999 political landscape to today's political landscape. So be sure to check that out in a couple of weeks. But speaking of politics, the beginning of 1999 saw Bill Clinton's impeachment trial, or I guess it really wasn't a trial, or it was a trial, according to the notes here. Nothing happened. You know, he was not voted out of office, because I think a lot of people, you hear impeachment a lot today, and I think a lot of people assume that once you're impeached, you're automatically thrown out of office. So I just want to make sure I had terminology correct. But yeah, he was impeached for, you know, not having sexual relations with, but for perjury about alleged or unalleged sexual relations. But, you know, you look at that impeachment trial, and then in 2000, the Bush-Gore election, which, you know, went on for a month before we had a declared winner. And I'm thinking back into the early 90s. You know, 92 was my first presidential election, and I voted for Clinton because I felt George Bush was too out of touch with my generation, and I wanted someone younger, someone who would help, you know, my generation out. And then in 96, again, you had Bob Dole, who just, I think, did not have the stamina to be up there against Clinton. But you see this divining of kind of where we are today. And I guess we are going to get a little bit political on this episode because, well, when you talk politics, you have to. But this whole widening of people going either left or right, instead of and getting away from the centrist. And I think that is going to be the main key, especially in 2020, to help solve that cynical problem.
Yeah, I think the thing that shocked me the most was how fast the divide seemed to happen. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was there, and just this new political landscape gave people a voice to be emboldened to maybe, I don't know, share just how divided we were. I'm not sure. It just seemed like it happened really fast, that we went from, you know, being able to meet in the middle on a lot of things to just, that's it. You're either right or you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it is right now in our political landscape. And same thing, Chad, that, you know, the 90s was my first foray into taking part in the political system. I already had somewhat of a distrust of politicians, and I got that from my father, and so I didn't have a lot of hope, but I certainly never thought that it would get this bad this quick.
Yeah, and one of the notes that I had for 1999 was apparently MySpace was first launched. It didn't become popular until 2003, but it did switch over to a social media platform in 1999. And I think, you know, obviously social media is a tool that when invented, was probably thought to be a good resource and has really turned out to be it's Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. Instead of being used for positive uses, it's to highlight and give voice to the negative, to the extreme, and to give to make it seem like there is a bigger opinion than there really is on a lot of issues.
Yeah, we weren't ready for social media, and I some days I feel like we're still not ready for social media, and some days the internet in general. But there's no social responsibility in social media, and so I think that's something that really needs to be addressed, or we as a society need to really reflect on how we treat each other on that platform. Mm-hmm. But again, when it's used in such negative purposes so often, I don't think those type of groups aren't going to reflect or say we're doing it wrong. Okay, we'll stop. So you're right. It's Pandora's box, and what do they say about Pandora's box once you open it? So there, all we can do is try to manage the damage that's being done now at this point, which is just another thing that lends to that that current state of cynicism that mm-hmm. so many people reside in, and why it's going to be so hard to change it.
Yeah, I mean, we've discussed on our episodes, you and I, Travis, and on other episodes here on Positive Cynicism, social media is just, it seems like the fact that no one seems to have a filter when it comes to throwing out messages on social media. It's like, I think it's the the fact that you can be anonymous on social media, or even if you use your real name, the fact that you can say things without having to say it to someone's face. And that goes into
it's like being in a bar and mm-hmm. everybody's drunk, right? Yeah. And everybody just feels like they can say whatever they want with no consequences, because when they type it, there's no consequences. There might be consequences the next day. Yeah. There might be immediate consequences on the other end for the receiver of that, hateful or spiteful, mm-hmm. whatever the message is that you sent. But for you personally, for the one communicating the message, there's no immediate consequence. You shut your computer down, you turn your phone off, and you're done. So, yeah, it is I absolutely, the anonymity.
There you go.
Always struggled with that word. is a big... And you're not even anonymous, as you said, but it's the lack of immediate consequence. Whereas so many things are said that we just never would dream, at least for now, I should say, I say this, but I could change 5 years, 10 years from now, this could be all different. But just seeing the communication that happens online and then imagining people just regularly talking to each other like that face to face, that would, today. Mm-hmm. Almost never happen. You run into some people that live their lives like that, where they just, and they make it uncomfortable for everybody else, and it's but who knows, if that becomes the norm because it's been regular, or it's been it's been turned into a norm online, mm-hmm. then maybe it will start to seep in more into our face-to-face communication. That's a scary thought.
Yeah, it is, because I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to say it's not, because if you actually had to face consequences for things you say, maybe it would get people to think before they speak.
Yeah, that won't happen.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to be positive. going back to 1999, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit, go into sports. This also plays into the cynicism role that we talked about, or have been talking about. 1999 saw Lance Armstrong win his first Tour de France. And he won 7 Tour de France's in total. And then, of course, they were all taken away from him in 2012 for drug use, failing drug tests. But I remember probably not the first Tour de France. And apparently the cops are coming now, because we've been talking. Yeah, you can hear that. But I think it was probably around the third victory for Lance Armstrong that people started paying attention to him because he was winning every year, and it kind of gave people hope. You know, they could live vicariously through him, and then to find out that he was allegedly doping. I say allegedly, even though he felt, I think he has claimed some sort of innocence. But we just look at sports athletes now. You know, you can look back at Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa. Whenever an athlete does well or goes above and beyond, instead of immediately thinking, oh, he's a great athlete or she's a great athlete, it's, okay, what performance-enhancing drugs are they on, or how are they rigging the system to do better than everyone else?
Yeah, because, you know, we've seen it so many times now, and it's, we have access to that information when that happens, where in the past it might have been, you know, kept internal. There's so much, you know, you look at, especially in the NFL, and they talk now about just in the 80s when they just loaded these guys up with painkillers and put them back on the field. And we've seen the CTE, and we've seen just the physical breakdown of some of these, you know, veterans' bodies now. But now we hear about it because there's the positive side to social media, right? Everybody has a platform that they can access where that didn't exist back then. So to try to keep it positive, there's that. So, but on the flip side, then same thing. When our heroes stumble or completely fail us, it's out there and very readily accessible, not only to us as adults, but to our kids who look up to these athletes a lot more than we do typically.
Yeah, and we discussed it, I think, on the last episode about athletes not being role models. But at the same time, if your child, you know, wants to be an athlete or play sports, they're obviously going to look up to players in that sport. But I blame fans as well, in the sense that we want the best. And you know, Daniel Tosh has an old joke about pumping athletes full of steroids because he wants to see them do the best they can, and if they die early, well, at least he was entertained. And I think we have that mentality. I believe UFC was already popular in 1999, but there was that, you know, when UFC started getting popular, it was there were a lot of comparisons to like the gladiator days, and just getting the entertainment value of people beating each other up. And, you know, same way with football now, where the NFL has made a lot of rules over the last couple seasons to try to limit concussions and any type of serious injury. And you always, whenever they come up with a new rule, there's fan backlash because, you know, they call it the no fun league, or saying that soon it's going to be two hand touch or flag football, because that's like social media where there's no consequence. If you're not playing the game, you don't have to deal with, you know, the sore body the next day or the mental trauma. You just want to see the best game that you can see.
Well, it's such a double-edged sword because you're right that there is some onus that falls on the players. You know, it always surprises me when you keep hearing the league saying, you know, we want to protect our players. We want to, you know, that we're going to have the best technology, and we're going to make sure that we teach them how to tackle correctly, and we don't want to see. And then when it's game time and these guys are on the field, they are trying to take each other's heads off. And, you know, they can't have it both ways, because then the players will turn around and say, the league doesn't care about player safety. Well, neither do you guys half the time, because you're the ones out there that could just make a tackle. And, you know, I go back and I'll watch a lot of classic football. And classic for me is, you know, 80s. Mm-hmm. And I'll watch even the 85 Bears, which is a terrible litmus test because they were looking to tear people's heads up. But they, even then, the way they tackled compared to some of these guys now. And again, 85 Bears probably isn't a fair. How about the teams that were trying to tackle the Bears players on offense? They you know, even the tackling was different. And that's a product of the ESPN era that we live in now and have lived in since the, you know, mid to late 90s when ESPN really took off and there was, you know, ESPN Ocho. but, you know, it's that I want to make the big play. I want to make the big highlight to be on the top, you know, SportsCenter top 10. So some onus falls on the players. If they're going to complain about player safety, they need to practice what they're preaching and on the field not try to rip their opponents' heads off, literally, which some of those tackles, you know, almost do. But then, yeah, of course, we have to understand that it's a game of performance and that their next contract, their next big payday is going to be based on their performance. So they're going to be looking, just like we do in our jobs, looking for every possible advantage that's maybe, you know, that's within the rules, within the guidelines. And so, you know, the NFL has a list of banned substances, and then you see all sorts of ways that they try to skirt that and maybe, you know, get around that sort of thing because they want their performance to be the best for them and, you know, for their team. So yeah, that's a really tricky thing. But you know, when you go back to the 90s, I think that's when you almost saw the rise of the super athlete, right? I mean, we weren't that far removed from, you know, the NFL of the 70s where that was, you know, guys were working part-time jobs in the off season, and you know, cut to 20 years later and we've got, you know, mega millionaires many times over in the same sport. So definitely, you know, so why the increase in, you know, all the not substance abuse, but banned substance abuse is, you know, well, there you go. You went from just being, you know, making an average Joe payday to, mm-hmm. to being one of the highest, you know, paid athletes in the sport.
Yeah. And I mean, if you are a talented athlete, it is, you know, the easy money is just this dream where you can use your skill and better your life very easily, you know, on draft day within like an hour. You can make more money than you probably ever dreamed of making. But real quick, I was going to say, do you know, going back to the 85 Bears, the one team that did do well against them? And
yes. That would My Miami Dolphins.
Yes, the Miami Dolphins, the yes. one glowing highlight of 1985.
Right, protect that perfect season.
Yes, yes. And that's the one that made me a Miami Dolphin fan and gave me 35 years of misery ever since. Nah, joking. But yeah, going back to the 90s, 1999, I think trying to spin this, take this off the cynicism that we've been dealing with for the last half hour. But I think we looked at it as the coming of the new millennia, the new century that we were heading towards. I think there was a lot of optimism at the time because just this, you know, surrounding era of the 2000s. And you look back at movie, at any type of pop culture that looked forward to past the year 2000, prior to 2000, and you know, you would see like the flying cars and the optimism and all this stuff that has yet to come to be. And now anything that looks at the future is like the dystopian future. I wonder where we could have been had we remained optimistic instead of, I guess, realistic.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a long running gag, right? I mean, yeah. It was they had it on Conan, the bit with in the year 2000, yeah. Right? In the year 2000. And it didn't ever come to fruition. But, you know, we really did stumble into the 90s, too. When you look, you know, we ended with Y2K. And, you know, that was a fun time for me because I was in the news business and we did so many Y2K stories, and it was just so interesting. We went into people's homes that were preppers, and it was kind of back before prepping was a thing, you know, because like you said, it was just such a good, you know, positive time that, I mean, sure, people still did prepping, but not anywhere like they do now. And so that was interesting to see somebody, you know, have a whole building, outbuilding full of supplies ready for the Y2K to just bring down the banking system and everything around us. And of course it didn't happen, but little things too that you don't think about, like the, you know, the library, who had by that point gone all digital and did a, you know, card catalogs weren't in the, and so they were like, well, we still have our old card catalogs that we're ready to bring out if we need to, and just all sorts of things. So that was interesting. But then, you know, we survived Y2K, but then, like you had mentioned earlier, with the Bush Gore election, and then of course 9/11, and so that was a real stumble into this, you know, the year 2000 and the decade that we thought we'd have the flying cars and all the other great stuff that that looked then very, in a very short time, looked very different and gave us that kind of dystopian feel of that myth, I guess, that we felt secure in as the superpower of the world was certainly shattered, and then the war that followed, I think, further pushed a lot of us into a more cynical place, and yeah, we were off and running.
Yeah, I was gonna say, go back to Y2K real quick. I'm sure there is more written on this that I could have looked up prior to this episode, but I seem to remember like Y2K coming out of nowhere and being like, oh my gosh, you know, everything is going to end because all the computer systems are not set up for the changeover. But I'm going to guess that computer programmers and everybody had been aware of this situation years prior, and any and a lot of the work that needed to be done was already well in place to do so. I'm going to take the cynical route here now to go with the media being like this focus on Y2K and promoting it as a potential, you know, end of the earth scenario, where now we look at the media with a lot of distrust. And I just wonder if you think that, I mean, obviously there are several other examples you can pull from the last 20 years or 30 years even, but like the media overhyping, and especially now in this age of 24-hour news cycles where you have to have something to fill time, and especially with online content as well, do you think Y2K was overhyped because it played well to an audience?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you're, like you had said, with all the groundwork that was probably done ahead of time, this is like, you know, every disaster film that starts with the quick montage of how, you know, a quick 15-minute montage of, you know, who discovered the problem, how, you know, how it started, what are all the scenarios, how is it going to become a major disaster, and then you've got like your one whistleblower, you know, that gets it out to the media, and then, you know, about your almost to the midpoint in your film, it's a full-on panic, and full, you know, cities are evacuated because of the panic that has started by the media. So for Y2K, yeah, we're dropped right into the, you know, final months of 1999 when we're at a you know, fever pitch of fear, and yeah, I mean, we looked at every angle. I mean, we went to the county clerk's office and talked to them about what they were going to do if, you know, on January 1st the computers did not turn on, and how they were going to continue to serve the public. Every possible angle. I was doing some, and reporters were looking at every possible angle for weeks and weeks. So sure, the media played a big role in that. You know, the distrust, the 90s, I think, is the big time that can be looked back, because it was the, you know, the first Gulf War gave rise to CNN, which CNN had been around for a decade, and it was just something that was always there, but it wasn't, it hadn't really caught traction, and it wasn't that legitimate source yet that people had gone to. Therefore, no one looked at that 24-hour model like anything that would be feasible. And then during the bombing of Baghdad, they were the only news organization that was able to stay on the air. And so through the bombing of Baghdad, everybody began to turn to CNN, and all of a sudden they we're credible, like literally overnight. And so here comes the 24-hour news model now, because CNN was doing it, and we want to be the next CNN. And so flash forward now to today, and there's just that model ate itself. That model caused this just constant need to have breaking news. It's why every time you turn on any 24-hour news network today, there's going to be a breaking news label, because they want to look. And that's why, you know, you're going to do things wrong when you have that time push, which news was always about time, but it was also about being right. And now it's about being first. And so it leads to a lot of mistakes. It leads to pressure to fabricate. It leads to all these other things that model that began back in the early 90s with CNN and their success during the Gulf War, I think is a big reason to how we got to today with our distrust of the media, that and our politicians calling the media the enemy of the state. Doesn't help.
Going back with Y2K, that it also didn't help that the internet was still in its infancy, pretty much for widespread use outside of college campuses, and the personal computer was still relatively new in the household. So I think that helped strike people's fear as to, whereas if it had been, say, 10 years earlier, I don't think it would have been as big of an issue, because people wouldn't have, you know, if you can't directly relate to something, it's not going to affect you as much. But when you bring something into the house, then it's like, oh my gosh, how is this affecting me? And common sense, in a sense, takes a back seat.
That, and, you know, 10 years prior, we weren't as dependent on computers yet. So, you know, a lot of the issue was just that we'd given so much power, I suppose you could say. We relied so much of them in our everyday lives now. And like I said, they were starting to pop up in all, you know, in homes all over. And so, sure, there was more awareness of computers, awareness of the reliance on the computers, and that certainly, I think, also helped kind of build this fear of the unknown of what might happen there. And could you imagine what would have happened if it did actually happen? Like, the disdain, the distrust, would we be in the same... Would it look the same right now? Would our society look the same had Y2K shut down the country?
Yeah, or would we have just gone back, say, 50, 60 years and had to rebuild everything?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, this is a good, great concept for a film. A little revisionist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's been done, but I think it's probably on an indie level somewhere. But
yeah
that'd be a fun... an interesting look.
Yeah, is it the final countdown where the troops get sucked, or a ship gets sucked back in time to go to Pearl Harbor right before the attack?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, yeah, so it'd be something like that where...
Right.
Yeah. There you go. That can be your next next screenplay.
Yeah.
All right, before we wrap up here, I just want to... I have a list of some people that we lost in 1999, and which I think, kind of looking at them... at this list, I think it kind of plays into the cynicism role as well that we've been discussing. And the first name that I have is Gene Siskel. You know, Siskel and Ebert, probably the two foremost movie critics. And I don't know how you feel about critics of film, if you rely on them or read them, but I think Siskel and Ebert are probably the only two people that... carried enough weight to actually affect people's opinion, besides Armand White, I guess. But
I have a great appreciation for film critics, and I think that it's important that when people do read their work, they have to remember that film is art and therefore subjective. So they certainly, you know, they shouldn't feel the need to agree with them, and no critic worth his or her salt should expect their readers, listeners, watchers to agree with them either. And I think if you go into any critic's work of anything that's subjective like film is, then I think you'll be okay. But so, yeah, I myself have a book full of film essays, Latchkey Kids Take on Modern Cinema, available now on Amazon.com. I have an appreciation for the work that the good critics. Now everybody's a critic now, and jumping on Rotten Tomatoes doesn't make you a film critic. Yeah. But.
Well, and you can go back and listen in the archives to our Corey Haim discussion, where we play a clip of Siskel and Ebert reviewing License to Drive. And needless to say, that's one criticism that I disagree with them strongly on. Mm-hmm. But then a few months after Gene Siskel, Stanley Kubrick passed away. And I believe he was working on AI at the time, and then Spielberg took it over. I'm assuming you have seen AI.
Of course.
Do you feel the ending was a Spielberg ending, or do you think that was Stanley Kubrick's original
ending? I didn't care for AI, so I'm going to guess it was Spielberg. Only because a Kubrick slant probably would have had me more excited about it.
I was going to say, are you not a Spielberg fan?
No, I am. But I'm a Kubrick fan too, and just his I'm not a Spielberg
apologist.
I'm not a Spielberg worshiper. Where I might, if it's Kubrick, I'm a little more excited about that. So that's why if I had to choose between the two, I'd probably say Kubrick. But
And this next name is one that I didn't realize was still alive in 1999, and that's Joe DiMaggio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was 84 years old.
Oh, my goodness, yeah, okay.
Because I believe it was around 1968, 69, when Simon and Garfunkel were asking Joe DiMaggio, where have you gone? So I just figured he was gone ever since then, but... Yeah. And then May 23rd, this is one that I know hit home for both of us. Owen Hart died during a WWF, now WWE event, when he fell from the rafters at the Kemper Arena in Kansas City, Missouri. And that one,
still an event that's talked about so much today. I mean, Owen was just such a beloved figure in that industry.
Yeah, and it's. I'm sure there's a thought here on wrestling and cynicism that I could tie it into, but just the fact that, like you said, I've never heard a negative thing said about Owen Hart, and as Billy Joel says, only the good die young. But it's just a shame that he was taken in the manner that he was, as well. And I couldn't imagine being there in the arena that night. And seeing that. And then the last one, and kind of going kind of in the same vein as Owen Hart to an extent, I guess, is JFK Jr. He and his wife were.
Yeah.
And I remember, because I was working in a TV station when this happened, and I believe it was like wall-to-wall coverage for the weekend that his plane disappeared and went down. And it's just, I guess my one advice is always, if you are a celebrity, never get on a small plane. You would just think, after all the movies and everything we've seen, like, that's not a wise decision, but yeah.
And certainly don't fly one.
Yeah.
Denver, JFK Jr. Yeah, don't fly. You're right, because he was flying the plane, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think to tie this all back into a loss of innocence or something in that regard, his passing kind of was the end of Camelot with the Kennedys. I know Ted Kennedy was still alive, but he was older, and JFK was like that next generation, and they were the first American political family in a regard of I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but it was just that the Kennedy, you hear so much about the Kennedys, and I think had he lived, I don't know if he would have gotten into politics, but I think he would have at least done something politic adjacent, trying to influence policy or something like that, just because it is in the Kennedy blood.
Well, especially today with the, you know, the era of celebrities getting involved and or becoming president.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. Well, how about some how about some costs of things in 1999, Chad? And these are, you're going to appreciate this because this is per AOL.
What's that?
I thought it was only fitting. I had to go back to a list that was put together in 2009 when AOL was relevant. Not really even still, but still updating their website. Do they even have a website? Okay, so an ounce of gold was $279. Now, I don't have current prices to compare these, but you know, I don't know how much gold you have.
You know, I don't really listen to Glenn Beck, so I never bought gold.
Right. Okay. Well, so all I can tell you is it was an ounce was $279. A New York Times daily edition was 75 cents. The largest Slurpee available at 7-Eleven was 99 cents. A gallon of gasoline was $1.30. Wasn't that a time to be alive?
Yeah, and the day after, or the day this episode comes out, is a day after, I believe, California and Illinois gas taxes take effect, to where they are, I believe, the two highest states with gas prices. So, yeah.
I can relate to this, and I know you were just there, so you can too. A Disneyland one-day adult ticket was $41, which sounds like a steal when you compare it to today's. This also sounds like a steal. The average expanded basic cable, so that's like not the generic 1 through 20, but the big all the way up to, you know, 45 or whatever at the time, $31 for basic. So just a little, a six pack of Bud cost you $4. Movie ticket would only cost you $5. So, yeah, you know, I think CNN, I think, ran a special, you know, they did the decades and they did the 90s, and they said it was the title of, I think, the whole thing was the series was The Last Great Decade? And I think it's a valid question because, well, first of all, the 2000s, first of all, we need to decide what we're calling the, no one has decided yet. We've got the 80s, the 90s, and then, well, we've got the 2000s, but that technically could be the
100
whole
years. Yeah.
So is it the 2000s and then the 2010s is what we'll get back into, and then the 2020s for the next 10 years after, you know, after this year? So I assume that's how it's going to break down. But anyway, when's the last time you've heard anybody reference the 2000s? Or even the, or even our present day, which we're nearing the end. We're in the final final 6 months here. I mean, what is it known for? What is it versus all those other decades that are so easy to define?
Yeah, I've thought about this before, and it seems like, and I don't know if it's just we are at that age now where everything repeats itself, but, you know, you look at music, you look at fashion, all this movies, everything is repeating from previous generations, or or, you know, rebooting, or retro is now the new thing. And is it
your logo back? Yeah, it's all
Is it just because there are no original ideas, or is it companies just trying to cash in on nostalgia?
Yeah, I think that the easiest way to reach a huge amount of people is to appeal to that of which you know already exists with that nostalgia. And so if it's been long enough that it's hip again to go back to, like Pizza Hut is doing, then, you know, what's next? Are we going to see the, remember the red roofs that they used to have that like looked like a little barn? You know, are we going to see some of their buildings designed like that again? No, you're right. It's definitely, and I thought that a little bit about the 90s when bell bottoms came back, early 90s. We almost, you know, you saw it there. The 90s had grunge. They had that kind of leftover, real bright, colorful start. But then, you know, what were the, not necessarily with music, those the things like that's easier to quantify, but I don't remember any great, you know, clothing trends from the 90s outside of the grunge. And then I guess you had emo, right? Did that come in late 90s? So I guess there's some. but the 90s is still kind of hard to put it, you know, is the 90s what you had mentioned, the loss of innocence? Is that what it will ultimately be best known for? And I think to some degree, there's some validity to that, as we talked about already on the show.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to know what you think after listening to this episode. So feel free to reach out to me on Twitter at Chad Smart. You can also go to the Positive Cynicism Facebook page and be sure to leave a review wherever you're listening to this episode. We'll be back, like I said, all month of July 2019. We're going to be discussing various aspects of the 1999. Next episode, we'll be focusing on cinema in 1999, which, based on very little research right now, I think was the last year that there was, or one of the last years that remakes, reboots, and sequels really started to take over. So tune in for that in the next episode, which is also episode 100 of Positive Cynicism, which hopefully I had some big things in plan for the next 100 episodes. We'll see if they come to fruition. But Travis, thanks for joining me. As always, great conversation. And do you have any last things, or do you want to plug your websites one more time and your books?
Sure, yeah. A Latchkey Kid's Take on Modern Cinema, a collection of essays, and just I really enjoy doing research on film, finding out a lot more after I watch it, and so I drop some of that in on the films that I review, and there's 180 films, I think, in there. So, yeah, take a look. It's a fun, light read. A lot of modern films from the late 2000s, but certainly some classic ones in there as well, and reboots and remakes and all that fun stuff. So check that out on Amazon.
All right. Until next time, as always, question everything and do something positive. Dreaming.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.